So, after a couple of weeks off here, we're back to 1 Corinthians, still in the first section, the first four chapters, which deal with wisdom. And you probably remember that the first two chapters, 1 and 2, are this contrast, a contrast between what you can call just a human or a natural wisdom and God's wisdom. And Paul said that the cross, surprisingly, first exposes human wisdom as utterly worthless and worse than worthless. But then it only does that. God's goal is never just to empty us, right? But first to empty us and then in order to go on to fill us. And in the same way, the cross first exposes human wisdom as worse than worth. But that's only to then go on to reveal God's wisdom, which can only be revealed to those who have been emptied, right? That the requisite for learning God's wisdom is to be humbled, not to be humble, but to be humbled. And in a sense, the whole rest of the letter is simply Paul then applying that new wisdom of the cross to a whole series of issues that the Corinthians were facing in their daily lives and were asking Paul about and arguing with Paul about. And the first issue that he applies this new wisdom of the cross to is the problem of that he started the letter with, right? You may remember that the letter began with him pointing out that there were divisions in the church. And the problem, like we saw back then, isn't the divisions per se, but the fact that the divisions demonstrate that the Corinthians have the wrong attitude towards the ministers of the gospel, right? That they were divided, but the division actually bore witness to the fact that they were united in this human wisdom that led them to hold certain preferences among those that worked among them. The Corinthians preferred the preachers who lined up with their ideas of what a wise, successful messenger of divine truth should be like. And they prided themselves, this is the second level, kind of the bigger issue behind the unwise behavior. They then prided themselves with the thought that their preferences demonstrated their own insight and good taste, right? You notice how people do that with their preferences in the world? Yeah, it's like, whether it's teenagers with their favorite band or whether it's like middle-aged men with their favorite coffee. It's like they're very, this is the best coffee. But what they're really communicating is, I have the insight to know which is the best coffee, right? Somebody comes along and they says, oh, I was down at that restaurant the other day, had a fabulous steak, and someone else says, oh, you don't know what a real steak is, right? And suddenly we're in awe, not of the steak, but of them who know the difference, right? So this is what the Corinthians were doing. Paul already asserted that they should have seen by now that the cross exposes all of those judgments, the whole system of assessment that they were using, their whole paradigm, for people who like that word, right, to be a complete lie. So how should they look at the people who work among them? And that's what Paul deals with chapters 3 and 4, roughly. He wants to let the cross first dismantle their old understanding of ministry and then replace it with a new one. The passage that we look at today divides up neatly into two metaphors. The passage is chapter 3 from verses 5 through 17. And he uses the first metaphor, which is a metaphor of workers out working in the field, to make the point that neither Paul nor Apollos nor any other leader really matters at all. That the only one who matters is God himself. But then Paul shifts to a second metaphor of a large-scale building project, and he uses that metaphor to warn the Corinthians that they need to watch how they go about the work of building their own church, because it is not their project. It is God's project. So this is 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 5 through 17. What, after all, is Apollos? And what is Paul? Only servants through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. The man who plants and the man who waters have one purpose, meaning the same purpose, and each will be rewarded according to his own labor. For we are God's fellow workers. And we'll talk in a minute how the idea there is really we, meaning Apollos and I, are just co-workers belonging to God. You are God's field. You are God's building. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds, for no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If any man builds on this foundation, using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It, referring to the day of the Lord, it, the day, will be revealed with fire, and that fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple, and that God's Spirit lives in you? Both of those use plural. Don't you know that you yourselves, plural, are together God's temple, and that God's Spirit lives in you, plural, collectively? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, for God's temple is sacred, and you, plural, are that temple. The word of God for the people of God. So Paul confronts their bragging about different leaders with the rhetorical question, what is Paul or Apollos or Peter? Anyway, nothing but servants. Of all the different words that Paul could have used here, like, who are they anyway? Apostles, messengers of God, ministers, elders. Of all the words he could have used, he uses the one with the absolute least prestige, right? The Corinthians have been priding themselves by claiming that they belong to people who are in fact the ones without any prestige at all. As the waiter who carries the dish to your table gets no credit for the culinary masterpiece on the plate, in the same way, neither Paul nor Apollos get any credit for the message that they preach. And as for the Corinthians priding themselves in preferring Apollos, can you imagine if two men both receive million-dollar checks in the mail, right? Lottery or court settlement or something. Two guys, two friends, they each receive million-dollar checks in the mail. And one of them brags over the other because the mailman who brought his check had a nicer-looking uniform. That's what they're doing here. In the prestige-driven world of the Corinthians, nothing could make less sense than priding themselves in belonging to a servant. Paul says, you're bragging that you belong to Apollos, but don't you know that Apollos is nothing more than that uncouth, unwashed day laborer in your neighbor's field? Who remembers the names of the men who set up the scaffolding for Michelangelo to paint the Sistine Chapel? Yes, Paul brought you the gospel, but it wasn't his gospel. Yes, Apollos taught you more about that gospel, but it wasn't his teaching. He didn't cleverly come up with any of it. They both simply delivered what God had given them. And what God had given them, not because they were so special, but because he wanted you to get it. God did one part through one person, he does another part through someone else, and he's going to still do other parts through still other people. And all the while, the only thing that matters is that it is God that is at work to take care of his people. And the person in between means nothing. The servants themselves will be the first to assure you that God alone is the one that produces anything worthwhile. The Corinthians pride themselves with their connection to people who actually don't matter. And worked in here is the idea that when God chooses to work through someone, it isn't anyone else's place to pass judgment on God's choice. Verse 5, servants through whom you came to believe, as the Lord assigned to each his task. Paul reminds them that God, not the church, not in Corinth, not in Jerusalem, not in Antioch, appointed him, and he hints at what he's going to say more directly a little bit later in chapter 4, which is essentially, you know, you don't like me or how I do what I do, I don't care. Take it up with my boss. I work for him, and he's the only one that I care about. Paul hints here that to pass judgment on the servant that the Lord chose is getting really close to passing judgment on the Lord. From Paul's point of view, he serves the Lord. His reward is only from God, and so he cares nothing about what the Corinthians think about him. But at the same time, he cares very deeply about whether or not God's work will get done among them. And so he cares very, very deeply about whether they will honor and respect God. And so he does care that they understand that to have contempt for him is to have contempt for who God chose to send. Right? In one place, Paul talks about this as the difference between his person and his office. He cares nothing what they think about him as a person, but he is passionately concerned that they respect his office, because on that hinges the work of God's gospel among them that he is passionate about. This is along the lines of Jesus' words, "Whoever receives you receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me." Paul, at the same time, cares zero what they think of him, but if they don't listen to him, God's work doesn't get done, which he cares a lot about. The last line of this section needs comment, and I already snuck the comment in as we read, right? Here, when it reads, "For we are God's fellow workers," that wording can give the idea that Paul's image is Paul and Apollos and God, kind of all on a team, right? We are fellow workers of God, right? And that is not what he's saying, right? In a way, that is true, right? God brings us into his work to work with him. But here, in the context, Paul has been emphasizing that it is God's work alone from start to finish, and that they are nothing, that God is everything. He is the one that does the work. Okay? Here, as I said, fellow workers refers to Paul and Apollos' roles or responsibility or relationship to one another, that they are nothing more than just guys on the same team, pursuing the same goal. For people who have the more updated NIV, you may not realize there are a couple of different versions of the NIV. The one that we have here in the pews is the one from, I believe, is 1984. In 2011, there was an update, and interestingly, this wording was changed. In the updated NIV, it was changed to we, Apollos and I, are co-workers in God's service. Okay, the two things he's saying here are, one, Apollos is an I relationship. You've seen us as in some sort of competition, and Paul says, no, we are absolutely on the same team, pursuing the same goal in obedience to the same coach. We are nothing more than co-workers. We look at one another as just guys doing a job together. But then the second piece, and the more important piece here, is the fact that, not the co-worker bit, but the idea that they're co-workers belonging to and obeying and following God, who is the one who is at real work. If the Corinthians have been blessed in any way, then it is not because Paul showed up one day, and it's not because Apollos came along afterwards. It is because God reached out to them to do his work, regardless of the through whom. That same verse, verse 9, also makes this transition from the first metaphor to the second, the image of the field to the image of the building. He says, we are fellow workers belonging to God, and you are God's field. You are God's building. And again, here, the emphasis, and when I say emphasis, I mean an actual demonstrable grammatical emphasis relating to the word order in Greek. It's actually, when we talk about emphasis here, this is a objective, this is what is emphasized. The emphasis here is on God, okay? This, what Paul's saying here isn't the new teaching of what the church is like. You guys, you're like a field bearing a harvest. You guys are like, you're like a building being built up into a beautiful temple. That's not the new thing here, okay? The idea is that they've always known that they're a field in which a harvest is being cultivated. They've already understood that the church is being built up as a temple of God. And what Paul is saying here is like, yes, you guys are a field, but that field belongs to God alone. Yeah, you guys are a building and you're being built into this beautiful temple, but that temple only belongs to God. That's where the emphasis here is. It isn't new teaching that they're like a field or a building. It is, in as much as they're a field, it's God's field. In as much as it's a building, it's God's project. Paul and Apollos are at work, but it's not their work. They're just servants. And while the work is the actual lives of the Corinthians themselves, while the community that's being built up is their community, it doesn't belong to them either. The idea that the building up of the church in Corinth isn't their project, it is God's. And that's what Paul deals with in this second metaphor. Having set up that image of the church as a building, he says that when he first came to Corinth, he laid the foundation. He refers to himself as an expert builder, but he isn't bragging there because he says that it is entirely by the grace God has given me. He might have looked like the architect on the scene, but the plans were drawn up by God. And then most of the rest of the passage, after he talks about how he began the work, most of the rest of the passage is a stern warning to those who would continue the work of building God's temple, right? Which, again, is a metaphor of helping the church and its members grow up into the full likeness of Christ, which in the context is addressing all these issues that they're asking him questions about. All these questions in the rest of the letter about marriage, questions about idolatry, questions about eating meat, questions about all these other things, these are the actual work of building up the church, building up the members of the church into the full likeness of Christ. The work of building up the temple of God in Corinth. So the question is, who does Paul have in mind with this warning? Okay? Is this, as I've often thought in the past, an indirect warning to Apollos? as though Paul is concerned that Apollos has been muscling in on his territory, that Paul is concerned about what direction Apollos might be taking the Corinthians. And an attentive reading says, almost certainly not, right? Every time Paul has mentioned Apollos, Paul has stressed how they are working together, that they have the same vision, each one doing the job that the Lord has given them to do. Later in the letter, we have evidence that Paul has been trying to get Apollos to go back to Corinth. Okay? This warning, it turns out, is being given to the Corinthians themselves, especially those among them who are stepping up into leadership roles. The people who are writing the letters to Paul, the people who have taken upon themselves to argue with Paul about the things that he has written back, the people who are influencing the congregation as they address the sorts of questions and issues that come up in the letter. As Paul has tried to give a gospel perspective on these issues, some, and perhaps most, of the prominent people in the Corinthian church have been arguing back, disagreeing with Paul, challenging his ability and challenging his authority, and conducting themselves as though they really know better. And so here, Paul is warning them. Okay, you want a seat at the table? You want to pick up tools and get to work together with us? You can do that. But you watch how you do it. Because it's not your project. This building is God's temple. So you better be darn sure you're doing it the way he wants it done. That's Paul's warning here to the Corinthians themselves, as they step up to do the work of organizing their lives as individuals and as a community. And as they do it, built on the assumptions of a human natural wisdom. When Paul refers to building with either gold, silver, and precious stone on one hand, or with wood, hay, and straw on the other, and people sometimes try to take all of those six words and break them down, that each of the different words means something different, that's pushing the metaphor too far. Paul here is thinking in two groups, working with gold, silver, and precious stone, or working with wood, hay, and straw. When he uses that metaphor, he is speaking of the human and divine wisdoms that this whole section has been about. To build with gold, silver, and precious stone is to approach the Christian life, both individually and more importantly, collectively in this context, with a mindset, with values, with methods taught by the Spirit through the message of the cross. Because remember, this divine wisdom is the wisdom that we see in a crucified Messiah. Conversely, to build with wood, hay, or straw is to approach the questions of the Christian life as an individual, or even more so as a church community, with the presuppositions, the goals, and the methods of the natural person, the things that we breathe in with the air from day one. To approach any church question, from finances, to ministries, to decorating the building, with your own goals and preferences in mind, is to build with wood, hay, and straw. The only thing that counts as gold, silver, and precious stones in the work of the church is the pursuit of God's revealed purposes, his mission. When we decide whether or not to pursue some ministry, the only question is, how does this line up with God's mission? When we make decisions about our budget, the only question is, how does this line up with God's mission? When we deal with questions of church discipline, The only question is, how does this line up with God's mission? When we decide what color to paint the pews, the only question is, how does this line up with God's mission? Woe to him who handles the things of God on his own terms. I frequently say, this is your church. About a month ago, I said that, right? And I said, but not really, which we'll talk about. Well, today we're talking about it, right? I frequently say, this is your church, right? And when I say that, it's because I want to convey that it doesn't belong to the pastor or to the staff or to a denomination or to a church board or to leadership. That all of those different roles are servants of you. And that this is your church. And unless you step up to build the church is stagnant and will die. There is nothing here except you. This is your church. But that's only part of the truth. It's a partial truth to dispel a misunderstanding. It is not your church in the sense that you do not get to do what you want with it. It is God's church. And everything we do or decide, the only thing that matters is what God wants with his church. We might have a discussion. We might even put a decision to a vote. But that, we have to be very careful that we understand what we're doing and why we do that. We do not discuss or vote because we believe the majority should get their way. God should get his way, even if every single one of us thinks otherwise. We hold a discussion, or perhaps even a vote, because we believe that the Holy Spirit resides primarily in his people collectively, so that the discussion or other apparently democratic process is only a means to determine the mind of the Spirit. Democracy is not a core value of the church. Democratic processes are a means to discern and submit to a divine autocracy. And when we're not clear on that, the democratic process will always lead us astray. It will lead us to simply majority rule. And whether majority rules or minority rules, it's still a human wisdom. When our processes are consciously aimed at and we use them to pursue knowing what the Lord desires, then the Spirit can use those processes to lead us to what he desires. Going back to picking up Paul and the different people who are at work in the church, some of them building, led by this divine wisdom, others building, perhaps still led by human wisdom. Paul says that who does what will in the end be revealed. Continuing the metaphor of this building project, Paul says that at the final judgment, which in the Old Testament is frequently pictured as a day of cataclysmic fire, he says that all things we have done will be revealed for what they are. All the things we put effort into that were driven by an earthly, natural understanding of things will be revealed to be just that. Regardless of how successful they may have appeared. There will be a lot of people with very successful, powerful, famous ministries, with big, thriving churches, who the Day of Judgment will expose to be nothing other than empire builders. And at the same time, all that was done, led and empowered and guided by the Spirit, will also be revealed as such, regardless of how successful or unsuccessful it may have seemed. Now, Paul says plainly that he is not talking about salvation, because salvation is what God does for us, not what we do for him. And I don't think that's something that people get wrong reading this. This is one of those nice places where like you really like have no idea what Paul's talking about, and then there's like this one verse that's like, oh, clear as a bell. Oh, I get that. Okay. This is one of those, so I don't think that there needs to be a whole lot of comment on this. I don't think it's something people get wrong. But what about the reward that can be lost? Right? Paul says that those whose work is consumed by the fire will still be saved, but they will lose the reward. It is the joy of sharing in the good and glorious work of God. I remember very clearly when I first experienced just a sincere, sincere desire out of love to do something for God, for no other reason than it being for God. I remember very clearly, I had been a Christian for maybe 2 or 3 years, sitting in my third floor apartment. Esme wasn't there, so I assume it was, Thursday night that the women's prayer meeting was. And I was praying, and it just like began to hit me, all the things that God had done for me, simply out of his grace, me deserving none of it, and even very much deserving the opposite often. And it was one of these things, you know, talking about these things, it can seem like, you're kind of like, oh, look how spiritual I am. But the moments like this are so not you. You know in the moment that it is absolutely simply the gift of God. And my heart just filled with sincere gratitude and love for the one who did this for me. And I prayed, Lord, I know you need nothing. And there's nothing that I could ever do for you. But can you give me something that I can do for you simply because I love you? You make tea far better than I do, but can I make you tea? I know my tea is undrinkable, but can I bring you tea? It was one of the most heartfelt, sincere prayers of my life. And I believe that's because it did not originate in me. And at the end of life, what could possibly be more important? What could possibly be more satisfying? What could possibly touch that heart more than having something that you can lay at the feet of the Lord and see his smile and have him say, well done, my good and faithful servant. Because of your love for me, you allowed me to empty you and then fill you with myself, making you my vine, filling you with my sap, and look at the fruit we've borne. The question of whether we are governed by a human or a godly wisdom is not simply a matter of your own spiritual growth. It's not just simply a matter of you having better insight into which job offer will make you happy. Because God's work is a lot bigger than you or me. God's work is a lot bigger than the decisions that we make. Because you, plural, are the temple of God. And God's work is to build that temple until it fills all of the cosmos with the imminent presence of God. God's work is bigger than you or me because the Spirit dwells in you, plural. If we are governed by a human natural view of things, our participation in church affairs and decision making, even in the simplest of ministry roles, will lead the church astray and harm it. The word destroy here in the passage is a good example of the way that biblical writers exaggerate. And it's not like exaggerate in dishonesty, it's a use of language, like when Jesus speaks about hating people. Right? Here, destroy can mean, the passage in there. Destroy can mean nothing more than just damage. Making decisions based on human understandings of things damages the mission of the church. We can tear down what God is building. But the right response to that frightful warning is not to step back in fear and let others have their way. I might get something wrong, so I'm going to do nothing. How many people have been in a church situation where you were warned, don't touch the ark? Yeah, if Rob Marshall was here, he'd probably raise his hand. We've had some similar background experiences, right? Don't touch the ark, right? Trust the people who are really filled with the Spirit. No, the right response is to grow up, to let go of the things of childhood, turning from the old views and desires of the flesh, and by embracing the new way of thinking, the new way of seeing, the new way of doing that the Spirit reveals at the cross.